International, and a big look at the dark side of big data. Let's begin episode 215.
It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So, Ethan.
Yes.
Fans, crap, hitting. There has been a big awash about Rebecca Watson's comments and CFI's comments and how CFI isn't really CFI unless it's CFI, but then not that CFI. We mean this CFI. What the hell is going on with CFI?
Well, Don, I'm glad you brought that up because I was just waiting to discuss it.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. You know, I did sort of push this onto Ethan a little bit, but I think it's because everyone has been pushing on this, and Ethan is...
No, and it's important. It's important to clarify a few things because I've been getting a lot of questions myself. What exactly are we talking about when we say CFI transnational, and what are we talking about when we say CFI Canada? So I guess I'll start out by differentiating the two. CFI transnational is the American version of the Center for Inquiry. They spell center with E-R, whereas in Canada, we spell it R-E. Mm. That's not the only difference. No. Back in the old days, when CFI Ontario first came on the scene, it was a branch of CFI Transnational. They wanted to put a branch near Toronto because it was a big city. It was close to their headquarters in Amherst, and that's what they did. But over the years, CFI Ontario began to expand. It began to realize that there were simply limitations to having an American-run charity operating in Canada that just made things impractical. And also, there were other Canadian branches starting up, like in Vancouver and Calgary, etc. So a number of years ago, CFI became CFI Canada and separated itself from Transnational to the point where there basically is no formal connection between the groups anymore. CFI Canada has its own board of directors, operates under a different structure than CFI Transnational. Now, the name, the logo, and a lot of the terminology has remained the same, and understandably that can confuse a few people, but it's more of just it's a lot of work to go and change all that stuff. I mean, it would probably cost like $30,000 to go through, change all the notifications, all of the banners and advertising and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and it's just never been done. So when someone from CFI Transnational, namely Ron Lindsay, who is the CEO of the organization, says something stupid, and people say, that's it, I'm not supporting CFI anymore, it's not quite sure what they mean when they say, I'm not supporting CFI, which one?
So let's go to the people who aren't in the bubble.
Mm.
Ron said something that was not taken in a very good way. What exactly was the root of all of this controversy?
So CFI was transnational, was hosting the Women and Secularism Conference, the second annual conference that they've done. And as is customary with one of these conferences, the sort of head of the organization comes out and says something like, thanks for coming, glad you're all here, thanks for supporting us, have fun, enjoy yourselves, and let's get started.
I think one of the big words was just to say welcome.
Yeah, exactly. It's sort of the hello portion. So, I mean, every conference has one of those things. For some reason, at the beginning of the conference, Ron Lindsay came out and sort of said that, but then he sort of said, but also, sometimes privilege is used to silence men who should be talking about women's issues. And sometimes there's two sides to these whole things about harassment and stuff, and went on and on. And basically sort of everybody's kind of jaw sort of dropped, and they're like, what? And instead of sort of kind of backtracking and saying, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to say that, or even just saying, oops, I shouldn't have said that, whatever, my bad, he went on sort of the Blogverse and just made things worse. I think he compared Rebecca Watson to North Korea or something.
Yeah, something not quite appropriate. And actually, I was doing a bit of reading from Greta, blog posting about that. And it wasn't even so much, apparently, you know, what he was saying, which was in itself, but the sort of tone and the way it came over as sort of condescending. The idea is that, you know, this is our space, and we're letting you women have an opportunity here, but you better be good or we'll take your toys away.
Yeah, it was patronizing is what it, I think, came down to. And so, I mean, a lot of people were just really furious, and people started writing letters to the board of directors for CFI Transnational. They started writing letters to Ron Lindsay. And so after this has been going on for a couple weeks, the board issued sort of what's called a non-apology, sort of, we're sorry that you're offended.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, like, that's not really saying you're sorry. So people are justly quite upset. Particularly people like Rebecca Watson and Greta Christina. Some people have basically said, I'm not going to support CFI anymore. People have canceled speaking engagements, that kind of thing, which, and you know, my point of view on that sort of thing is I think people should do what they think is right. Like, I'm not going to criticize anyone for deciding they don't want to support an organization anymore.
Well, and the worst of it is, from again, what also was said about the conference itself, it was really sort of the foot in sort of the golden mouth, or gold, and I'm not sure quite how to phrase that, but Greta went on to say that actually, you know, technically the conference was great. You know, the conversations were really, really good. All the, you know, a lot of things were accomplished, but it was in this sort of backdrop, this sort of coffee room sort of conversation that there's this poison that Ron sort of put into it took its root. But one of the points, and you are associated with CFI, so I might be putting you in the spot a little bit here, but one of the points that has kind of come up is how come the non-CFI transnationals have not come out strongly condemning CFI Transnational and saying, no, we have a very different take on this particular issue.
Well, one of the reasons is sort of the question of why isn't CFI Canada doing more to sort of distance itself. There's a couple of reasons for that. One, for the past week, CFI Canada has been dealing with its own internal problems, big problems, and honestly, no one in CFI Canada cared or knew what CFI Transnational was doing. Like, it just wasn't on the table at all. So I'm sure that most of the CFI Canadian people are looking at this and going, what? Like, this is not factoring in or anything. So that's one reason. I think that it probably wouldn't hurt for the board of CFI Canada to issue some kind of statement to this effect. And, you know, unfortunately, I have no authority over them, so I hope they do that, but...
Well, I think the pressure is building, and they will at some point be forced to, whether they want to or not, just because. Yeah. But I guess in an odd sort of way, it does reemphasize that sort of separateness that you sort of mentioned between CFI Transnational and CFI Canada. The fact that CFI Canada didn't sort of see this coming, where if you were in it, you would be very hard-pressed to miss it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's one of those things where we can easily forget just how connected the community is. I think there's a perception that, like, sort of all of the group leaders get together and, like, talk things over and all friends and stuff like that, and we get on Facebook and we Skype each other. Doesn't happen, actually. Like, surprisingly... there are a lot of disagreements and arguments that spring up that are totally outside of the purview of other groups. And I can think of examples that I can't actually talk about on the air, but where you'll have one group have an internal dispute and, you know, someone who you think would know all about it is taken completely aback by that conversation even happening. So it's just one of those things. And... obviously, we hope that things work out for CFI Transnational. There are so many good people in that organization. I mean, people that I really respect who have given like 30 plus years to this movement. I mean, we can forget Canada CFI Canada is a newcomer on the scene. You look at the people who are involved who have maybe given 5-6 years to the free thought movement. Whereas CFI Transnational, you have people who have been 30 plus years working at this, building this sort of thing, and that's you feel bad for those people because they don't really get a say in the high levels of the organization. They're too busy, getting volunteers, planning events, and doing on-the-ground grassroots things. So I just hope people keep in mind that there's more than just Ron Lindsay behind CFI, right? There's a whole host of people who are really trying hard.
Is Ron Lindsay a bit libertarian? Because a lot of his arguments sound like that's sort of where I'm coming from.
I don't know. His background is in law. I don't know exactly what his political views are. I haven't heard it said that he is economically on the right, I guess, sort of Michael Shermer style, but I honestly don't know.
I was just curious because, again, from the real sort of wrongheadedness of what I read, what he said, it sounded like he's someone who says, no, listen, free speech is absolute and you have no right to exclude anyone for any reason, period, which is a typical libertarian sort of stance.
But it's also, that's one of the fighting words in the skeptic movement is the defense of free speech. I mean, there's a pretty famous incident where an atheist humanist group, I'm going to say it was in Washington, but I could be wrong, decided to defend the rights of a neo-Nazi group to march in the streets. Free speech, right? It decimated their group. Their membership plummeted. They basically folded after that. Now, I mean, they took a stance. This was something they believed in. It was a matter of integrity. And I guess you could say things like, this is they couldn't look themselves in the mirror and say we stand up for these values when we don't put them into practice. But it cost them the group's cohesion. So it's really hard to say. And I think that more place than others, I think in America, the free speech angle is more intensely fought over than it is in Canada. I think that perhaps Canadians don't see that as an integral part of the free thought movie as much as our American counterparts do.
Well, some previous leaders of
CFI
were a bit more in that vein, but that's history.
Yeah. Maybe we should take a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker. So please stay tuned and join us after this. A two-bit perfume. Your clothes are cheap. I see you walking with another creep. A two-bit perfume. Your clothes are cheap. All the bad girls.
Do you need someone to talk to? If you are seeking a listener who is non-judgmental, confidential, and familiar with resources, then a Speakeasy volunteer might be able to help you. AMS Speakeasy is a peer support service located in the North Concourse of the Sub. If you would like to speak to someone, come to the desk and tell a volunteer, or ring the doorbell located behind the desk.
$1 billion on the ground, all stretched out and uncurled, would extend about 4 times around the circumference of the world.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, RX Comics, Red Cat Records, the Regional Assembly of Text, Temple of the Modern Girl Boutique, the Wallflower Modern Diner, and Woo Vintage Clothing.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the Sub on the UBC campus or online at citr.ca.
Thank you. the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Understanding empowers you.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker here on CITR.
So, Ethan.
Yes.
Last week we talked about the good of big data. This week we're going to go and continue our discussion with big data, but this time we're going to take a look at the bad of big data, the dark side. So how does big data sort of present itself? Well, I'm going to break it down into roughly three categories: personal, corporate, and governmental. Personal data, we kind of already talked about with regards to the fact that we are great generators of data. We have our tweets, emails, phone calls, blogs, likes, pokes, and etc. We allow location tracking, tracking cookies, and click yes to those pages-long agreements when we want to install that must-have app.
Do we still do pokes?
Someone does pokes.
Okay. No? I don't know. I haven't seen a poke in a long time.
Yeah, I guess you're right. But So from this, we get what I'm going to call the bubble-fying of society. Not that I've invented that term, but this is where one of the ironies of having so much information in hand is the fact that we actually get caught in sort of custom content bubbles. In their efforts to sort of provide us better service via big data, companies like Google learn what we like so that when you do a Google search, you actually get results tailored for your own preferences. The good side of this is that if your parents are sitting there and they want to find out what kind of latex paint best bonds to the doghouse, you know, do a little spring cleaning, and they put in the search terms latex, bonding, and doghouse, well, in the old days, who knows what they would have gotten. But big data, smart enough to know, we hope, that they're not the kind of people to be into that sort of naughty stuff, but they do a lot of DIY and all that, and it will actually bring up paint sites. However, the downside of this is that when we do other kinds of searches, like Snowden and NSA, if you're like me, a bit of on the left side, you get sites like Democracy Now!, Truthdig, and generally pro-Snowden sites that often condemn the actions of the NSA and security state. However, if you're Harper and you do the same kind of search, and I'm going to assume that he's a bit more to the right than I am.
Just a bit.
Yes. You get a completely different set of results. You get things like Fox News, Sun Media, and generally pro-surveillance states and branding Snowden as a traitor. The bubblification of society means that there's less crosstalk, less mingling of ideas because literally they've been removed from your site. And we are only talking about the sort of our own self-generated data that sort of creates this ideological or social filtering. Now, this is actually what some people in the business call small data, which we might get into a bit later, that although it's large in historical context compared to big data, it's actually not that much information. You can actually sort of store on your own sort of computer or your own area. But instead, of course, we live in a paradigm where all that data flows out to some big corporate server, and thus we create big corporate data. Any thoughts on that, Ethan? Are you in an internet bubble?
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that because we've often talked about how practitioners of pseudoscience, if only they used Google, but if they're going to use Google and they're only going to get homeopathic sources or whatever, then we really can't blame them too much for not using just finding whatever they want to see and having it confirmed.
Yeah, and actually that is a perfect example. And one of the things, like, as you say, as a good skeptic, you have to be aware of that. I mean, most people are not willfully ignorant, but they usually are informationally disenfranchised. That's not the right
word. Well, I think that we just sort of naturally will believe the sources that confirm our already existing views, right? So naturally, if you're just looking for basic news, you're probably not going to turn to Fox News just because, you know, you're going to naturally just assume that, well, I'm right, so let's go to the news station that agrees with me.
Well, and I also think another thing that plays into this and why we're bringing it up on the show is a lot of people don't even know this is happening, right? I mean, if you sit there and you do a Google search, and then you go to a friend of yours who maybe have slightly different or very different interest than you have, the Google results are not going to be the same. They're going to be quite different. And I think people don't realize that this sort of big data filtering is going on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
Now, corporations collect mountains of data on everyone they come in contact with. That's why everything now on the internet you have to sort of register for, even if it's like free content and stuff. Because of the way the internet was originally set up, our emails are like fingerprints or maybe DNA. They uniquely identify us, and each one is unique. That's why they identify us. Amazon Chapters, Barnes & Noble, Audible, the audio bookstore, keeps track of every page you look at, every purchase you make. They cross-reference that with other buyers and thus, you know, give you information to try and get you to buy more stuff. In this way, it's almost like manipulating you to a certain degree. This information, of course, is collected from us. We give it away for free because we give it away for free and they make millions, even billions of dollars off this. One of the best ways to see how big corporate data has become ubiquitous with our lives is cloud computing. We think of clouds as sort of white, fluffy things, harmless and above us all. But the reality is there is no cloud. Cloud computing is simply a doublespeak term for their servers in LA or wherever. When you upload your information, photos, files to the cloud, what you're actually doing is downloading them to Google server farms or Microsoft or Facebook. You get the idea. We trust them, but why? Because it's a cloud thing and that somehow it's not real, so therefore it must be safe. Did you know that every email you send is anonymously scanned by a computer? Google does it, Hotmail does it. They don't do this to find out your secrets or anything like that, but it's part of the product that they do sell, marketing information. So if you know, if they want to know how many times how many emails are talking about Ford, be it the mayoral or the car variety, they're there and they're catching it. They're finding out what are the trendy catchphrases. This is perhaps the banal side of big data, but it's not really good, but it is mostly harmless. Ethan, does Google like your emails? Are you a popular Google?
I don't think so. None of my emails ever get scanned, or I don't get any advertisements for things that I talk about in my emails.
Well, you never know. It's so ubiquitous. This information, though, has other uses besides commercial. And this is where we move from sort of big corporate data into big government data. Obama has been giving much praise for his use of social media to motivate and bring out the base. But if you sit back and you think about it for a moment, a government official uses corporate and private databases to find out information about us so as to motivate, or if you want to be a bit more conspiratorially minded, manipulate us into do their political bidding. In Obama's case, of course, vote Democratic. And he's not unique. We had our own robocall scandal here in Canada where big data was used to attempt to subvert the Democratic will. There has been much lamenting about the dumbing down of the electorate, and part of it can be placed at the hands of big data. As big data begins to know more about us than we even know about ourselves, we get sort of the age of focus groups taken to the next sort of hyper level. Before anything is officially stated, there are leaks to the internet, status updates on Facebook, posting to forums, and then someone turns on something like Google Analytics or Google Trends or whatever tool they have at hand. They mine this big data to find out what is the lowest common denominator. What can be said without offending the least number of people? This is perhaps more innocuous side of big data, but there are worse sides. One of the interesting revelations that had come out of the Snowden data release, if anyone hasn't heard, I forget what his first name is, but Snowden broke out in The Guardian with a whole bunch of information about NSA searching. One of the interesting revelations that came out about this is perhaps an ironic thing about cyber battle plans the U.S. has had been working on. The government is quick to condemn hackers and other nations for turning the internet into a battlefield. Well, it seems that the U.S. is just perhaps even more so a cyber warrior against China than China's ever been against the West. Cyber war irony raises profoundly in that there's only been actually one true cybernetic attack on a nation for purely military reasons that we know of, and this was the Stuxnet virus that targeted Iran's uranium centrifuges. Ironic because the U.S., who claims to want to keep the internet a neutral space, that it will be attacked by enemy nations via the web, was actually the first nation, along with Israel, to actually create this sort of next generation of warfare. One hears of a hypocrisy of the U.S. after World War II wanting to create a sort of moratorium on nuclear weapons. Any thoughts on that, Ethan?
Well, one of the sort of aspects about the whole spying thing and this information that's out there is that the government was basically getting a lot of it from Facebook and Google and Twitter and other, you know, social media, social internet systems out there. And basically, it's a lot like the police getting a warrant to search your home or getting a warrant to go through your stuff. The government said, hey, we need to keep people safe, so we need to, like, spy on them and go through their stuff online. So it's really similar in that respect, and it's interesting that we have, I don't know, different reactions to this happening. It's one thing for police to come to our house and go through our stuff. It's another thing for the government to, you know, read our emails.
We're going to get to that later. But Ethan, just what about the thought about the internet being used as a battlefield? I mean, do you think it's like, and it was inevitable? Or do you think it's like, you know, it could have been like space where, you know, we seem to have managed, at least officially, not to put any arms in space.
Mm-hmm.
Well, astronaut arms, I guess, but...
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it was kind of inevitable. I mean, as soon as people find something new to walk or swim in, they've fought in it. So it's not surprising that we get the internet. There's going to be people fighting on it. So, yeah, I mean, it really is, again, it's just going to depend on what exactly can you do on the battlefield of the internet.
Yes. And sadly, it's going to be a new environment. So I'd like to say that the latest revelations from whistleblower Edward Snowden were new, but he's only the latest in a long list of people who have attempted to show that what kind of a surveillance state the, quote, free world has become. Snowden has exposed a couple of U.S. programs where they, among other things, are storing everyone's phone calls made in the U.S. or routing them or routed through the U.S. Well, okay, not exactly every conversation, but what's called metadata. Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi let it slip that this bulk vacuuming up of data has been going on since 2006. There has also come to light that a Dropbox of some sort, I'm not really sure what they meant when they used this term, is being used by the NSA, that's the United States National Security Agency, to duplicate and transfer internet traffic from all the major internet companies, Google, Facebook, Microsoft. The corporations, of course, are quick to point out that they haven't broken any laws, and they seem to haven't. They said, you know, what makes this very Cassie-esque, if you think about it, is that the legal justifications that they use for this sort of Big Brother surveillance is itself secret. So is the government essentially saying that what we're doing is legal, but I can't show you why it's legal, because if I did, well, that would be illegal. In an exchange where General Keith Alexander, NSA chief, told the U.S. Senate panel that the surveillance program actually stopped a dozen of terrorist events. When pressed to ask how many exactly, the number was classified, he said.
Traitor!
When Democratic Senator Jeff Markley held up his cell phone and asked, what authorization gives you the grounds to investigate my cell phone data? And again, he says, I'm sorry, but that's classified. And this is to, like, the Senate. These are the people who are supposed to be... Now, some people may say that they have nothing to hide. And besides, it's only metadata. It's not real data. What can they learn from that? Well, one hypothetical to make a point. Ethan, you kind of alluded to this. Imagine how you would feel if you woke up one morning and you saw someone going through your garbage. What if they did that every day? What if they didn't actually take anything from the garbage, but they made notes about... what you threw out, where you shopped, who sent you mail. Lightly, you'd be quite outraged and call the cops. How would you feel if every time you looked up and you found someone making notes about where you were, who you were talking to, what you bought, what time you're going to work, when you left? This is what we're talking about when we're talking about metadata. It is the fact that metadata, well, I guess data to some degree, is actually virtual. You can't see it, touch it, or smell it. The virtualness allows us to overlook the fact that it's real and can affect our lives. There have been many comments made that the government is not, in general, listening to our phone conversations. Well, there are sort of two points on this. First, it's not clear if VoIP, that's voice over IP, think of Skype, is considered a phone call or just internet data. The major protections for privacy were actually enacted several technological generations ago. The only metadata you could get out of a landline was where it was and who lived in that house. Because cell phones provide so much metadata, remember, we are great generators of this data, as we've already mentioned, the conversation itself becomes only a minor part of the data that can be mined. This brings me to a second point about why listening in on a conversation, the data, may not be as fruitful as you may think compared to the metadata. I mentioned in a previous segment that sort of praised big data about how we become fountains of data. Well, this can be used both to serve us and abuse us. You might ask, well, how could the non-talking part of my phone conversation reveal more than the talking part? Well, here's another sort of thought experiment. Let's envision a classic call. Hello, honey. Sorry, I'm going to be a little late, you know, work and all that. Eat supper and I should be home by about 10. That's the call. That's the part you get to listen into. And it sounds like our caller is a very productive and caring individual. However, if you looked at the metadata, we would find out the call made while they were actually driving a car and they weren't at work at all and they were going to the red light district. That he used the phone to pay for parking at a particular address. That after he made the call, he made another call to which you cross-referenced that number and you found out it apparently belongs to the Lonely Lovers, Inc. You can see by their built-in GPS that the phone stopped at an address of said Lonely Lovers, that the person stayed there for about 90 minutes, and that they'd actually turned their phone to send all the calls to directly voicemail. I could go on, but you kind of get the message. You can only find out, you can often find out a lot more from the metadata, perhaps much more than listening in. Even in this thought experiment, the conversation painted a very different and inaccurate picture of the scene than the metadata. And the metadata, it never lies. Thoughts, Ethan?
Well, why don't we just take a quick break here on the show, and we'll come back with my thoughts, the most important part, and more with Don.
Humor.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Gee, your station has a lot of problems.
Tell me about it. Just look at our morning guy.
Hello, this is Mole Man in the Morning. Good Mole Man to you. Today, part 4 of our series of the agonizing pain in which I live every day.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, not the home of Mole Men in the Morning. And we're back on Radio Freethinker.
Ethan.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about metadata?
Sorry, Don, could you repeat the question?
What are your thoughts? Well, okay. Just your thoughts on metadata.
Okay.
Let's keep it
simple. Yeah. So discussing the omnipresenceness of our data, the digital footprint that we lead, I mean, there's two ways you can look at this. One is that it's very scary and it can make you be a bit paranoid and you can feel like somebody's watching you. The other way of looking at it is that there's so much of it that it's how do you separate the relevance from the noise, you know? And to a certain extent, I mean, depending on how you look at things, I guess you could say, well, you know, how relevant is it that someone knows that I go to the 7-Eleven at 3 in the morning every night?
I can explain that, but I'm going to do that later.
Oh.
But here's a thought for you then, Ethan. You're kind of hitting at the one of the things that is sort of the we can enjoy the minnow effect, essentially, is that right now our ability to collect data is far surpassed from our ability to actually process the data, although that is quickly catching up. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the big data farm the Americans are making in Utah that's supposed to hold something like 500 zettabytes or some god-awful number. And you may or may not know that Canada's spy agency is building its new offices, so it's also expanding here in Canada.
Canada has a spy agency?
We have several. And actually, it's not CSIS that does this particular thing, but I also have that coming up later.
Oh, okay.
But I heard an interesting thought, and again, this deals both with the corporate side and the government side, is our digital exhaust. I heard that on one of my podcasts, and I thought that was quite an interesting concept, that we are generating all this data, and it's kind of like smoke that's coming out our back ends. And I don't know. So it doesn't bother you that they have this information, Ethan?
Well, I mean, to a certain extent, sure, it can bother me. But I mean, when you get down to it, is we're living in a certain time period where public information is so easily obtainable. Like, even before, like in my lifetime, I didn't grow up with Facebook or anything like that. But even before that, it wasn't really that difficult for, if there was a dedicated, I don't know, snooping detective who wanted to learn my secrets, it wasn't that hard for them to get them. I'm not, you know, James Bond or anything. I haven't cloaked myself in mystery. So it's not too different from how things were before.
Well, we'll get back to that. So let's go back to the sort of the big leak. And this is another aspect that's been sort of swept up, well, not swept under the carpet, but seems to be somewhat secondary. A few weeks ago, when the director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, and I do this part only because of the idea of doublespeak in 1984. Did you know, Ethan, that the sales of the novel 1984, since no one's released, had gone up something like 200%?
So you're saying this was orchestrated by the estate of George Orwell?
Yeah, something like that. Well, here's why it happened. So this James Clapper was asked by the U.S. Senator John Wayden during a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing, and I quote, "Does the NSA collect any type of data on any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? And he answered, and again I quote, "No, sir, not wittingly. There are cases where this could inadvertently happen, but not wittingly. With the revelations of Snowden, we now know this to be sort of a lie." When confronted with this lie, he responded by saying, and quote, "in what I thought was the least untruthful manner." Actually, the quote I had least most untruthful, but I think that's a typo. But I mean, wow, right? Republican Justin Amash put it actually very succinctly. Congress can't make informed decisions on intelligence issues when the head of the intelligence agency willfully makes false statements. Now, I looked up the meaning of wittingly, right? You know, just because maybe it means something that I didn't think it means. And it has two technical definitions. One is definitely a falsehood, so he was lying definitely, because it means, it's defined as being aware of or conscious of something, which, I mean, is painfully obvious that at the time he knew that this was happening. He could not have not known. The other meaning is done intentionally or with premeditation. Now, of course, this could fit here if we accept the fact that, and here's another one of my thought experiments, full of them this week, in the same sense that I wouldn't expect something if I was sitting there and I put a bunch of rocks into a river in order to make a dam. So my purpose is to make a dam, which is a sort of equivalent to theirs, we're collecting phone call data to catch terrorists. And I had no intention of causing a flood by the now blocked river by said dam, which is sort of the equivalent of them vacuuming up all the phone data to go back and find these terrorist calls. Another point of semantics is the word collected. To the U.S. security forces, they use a library metaphor. So let's assume all the phone data is a library. Which I guess he's sort of admitting when he uses this metaphor that they are storing all this data. So again, He knows what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
The agent, and who qualifies as an agent is something I'm going to bring up a little bit later. An agent has a library card that allows him to take out only select books. If he picks up a book and its cover says something about an American citizen, then he must put it back and get a FISA, which is Foreign Intelligence Security Act court order, in order to look at it. Which is in itself quite hilarious because, well, I'll go into that a bit later. So to the U.S. government, collection of U.S. personal data would mean taking the book off the shelf, opening it up, and reading it. And that they claim not to have done in mass. The Electronic Frontier Foundation points out that data acquired by electronic means is collected only when it is processed in an intelligible form. So processed now means collected, and collected means what again? They also go on to say that, in other words, the NSA can intercept and store communications in its database. They have an algorithm search that can search them for keywords and analyze the metadata without ever considering the communications collected. Only when an actual person looks at the data is it considered to be collected. This is sort of one of those great examples of sort of doublespeaks. And just one minor point, because the FISA courts, a lot of people make a note that, you know, they need to get approval from a FISA court to say this. And one of the big leaks that had come out with this Verizon, which was sort of the original one, was they went to several judges, and like five of them said no, this is way too broad, no. And then they finally found one judge who said yes. And he said, literally, you get to collect anything and everything you want, except for the actual context of the phone conversations, for a three-month period. So, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, we're after you, Ethan, and we're going to get a search warrant for you. The warrants have become so broad as to make this sort of check and balance absolutely meaningless.
Yeah.
So what do you think about the words, the doublespeak there?
Well, it's clearly duplicitous, and it's sort of obstructing the democratic process right there. I mean, what more can you say on that?
Okay. Of course, another thing that has blurred the lines between government big data and corporate big data is big bad data is its interconnectedness between the two groups. As already may be obvious, even if we assume operations, corporations are only collecting our data for a relatively harmless intent, you know, of selling products, that data can and has been laid at the feet of the state. Google and a few others have attempted to let people know when the government has actually made these requests for data, but under secret warrants, which is another aspect that exists both here and in the United States, who knows how many times they have lawfully but secretively forked over mountains of information. Released, I think it was just today or just yesterday, Yahoo had come out and they had said that in the last 6 months, the government had requested and got 13,000 requests for information in 6 months. That's one request every 20 minutes. And that's just in for Yahoo. That's not including all the other ones. There is another ominous link in that a large amount of the surveillance is not actually done by the government, but it's actually done by corporate contractors. I mentioned earlier that I said an agent with authority could check out a book, going back to our library metaphor. Well, what Snowden actually said was that a privately employed agent, such as himself, could perform any kind of sort of surveillance, and he used the example of wiretapping, that he had access to on their own authority if they had a hunch on it. And this is, again, is where when they get the warrants, they're so broadly worded that really they have no meaning in themselves. This, again, brings up three big threats from big data. First, when a court authorized a warrant, again, how broad is that warrant? The one that allowed the collection of phone data, you know, like I say, it literally said any tangible thing, all telephone data between the U.S. And abroad or wholly within the U.S. was fair game. The next threat is that if there's a person who has like a grudge, you know, whatever, he has at his fingertips the power to make someone's life hell, an ex-lover, high school bully, whatever. And lastly, there's this idea of crosstalk, and this doesn't often get mentioned, but these companies that have contracts for doing surveillance work with the government also do contracts with other corporations. I remember that there's one sort of conspiracy theory that at the time sort of seemed a little crazy, but now doesn't really seem all that nuts. Apparently, there was a New York attorney general who was pushing for major criminal charges against major corporate and financial institutions. The particular AG I'm referring to is Elliot Spitzer, who is pretty famous in his own right. He used an old forgotten law from the 20s that allowed him to sort of subpoena witnesses, and company documents pertaining to investigations of fraud and illegal activities. I mean, he's famously used his power to expose a lot of the wrongdoing of Enron and threaten civil actions against the financial institutions that were Enron's co-conspirator. When Spitzer ran for governor of New York as a reformer, he was elected in 2007, and less than 13 months later, revelations came out that he actually frequented prostitutes. Well, this was, you know, enough, of course, to destroy his political career, because Americans are the way they are. The conspiracy arises out of the fact that Homeland Security shares offices with Wall Street, the major trading financial institutions, they're sort of housed in the same offices because the same companies are doing the same sort of work for them. Cenk Uygur of Young Turks noted that these revelations sort of came out suspiciously weirdly, because it was one of those things that was like, follow the money. And you follow the money. At the same time, Homeland Security was following people's terrorist money, and they were sharing the same offices with the very companies Elliot Spitzer was out to get. Now, of course, you know, I mean, I'm not saying that this was a real conspiracy, but this is one of the things that happens that erodes people's confidence, because what was unthinkable, you know, a year or two ago is now, well, you know, actually, that actually could happen, and that's not good for democracies. When someone has access to big data, everyone, Prime Minister, all the way down to yours truly, there is something to be found out that could be used to manipulate or ruin that person. None of us are really free. I actually thought it was ironic because I was listening to another one of my podcasts, and they were talking about, they were contrasting the current situation to East Germany and the Stasi, that's their secret police back in the communist days, that most people in that society had, kind of like us, sort of accepted the surveillance. They had learned to deal with it, though. If they had something private to say, they would go out to the park and talk. If you used the public telephone to make calls so it couldn't be traced. Oddly enough, they were kind of more free than we are now. I mean, because technology has become such an embedded part of our very being, think of how often you see an under 20-something without their cell phone. How long any of us can go before checking our online status, and this is all sort of the voluntary surveillance. As a number of our listeners may recall, many months ago, there was a great scandal at a school in the U.S. when one of the techs at the school figured out how to remotely turn on students' webcams and monitor them without them knowing about it. Now, some people may say, as you did earlier, Ethan,
yes,
you have nothing to hide. And that may be true. But if the government is storing your data for years, maybe even decades, what if your name is similar to a real suspect, or there's a typo, or someone just guesses wrong? They can then get a warrant to actually go back and listen to some of this stuff in more detail. And then they have what we in the skeptical community call anomaly hunting. Did you know that when you bought that latte at Starbucks, the head of the Gambino family was also enjoying a coffee there? And how do you explain the fact that you brought a propane tank just 2 days before one of those propane tanks were used to kill a Gambino rival? And so on it goes. In the world of boundless informant and total information awareness, innocence and nothing to hide may only seem like lame excuses of someone who's about to commit pre-crime. I've often stated that one of the best ways to constrain and control the evils of our world, you know, corporations, GMOs, those sort of things, is with regulations. But, however, big data is sort of too big to regulate. It operates in the shadows and secret, and it literally knows everything. What do you think about that idea? I mean, you said earlier, I have nothing to hide.
Well, yeah, and that's a very real concern is, you know, there's actually, I'm going to talk about Star Trek now. There's actually a great episode in Star Trek called The Drumhead, where this judge comes to the Enterprise to investigate sabotage. And it just wraps up and up and up and up until they've got the captain on trial for being a traitor. And there's this line about, you know, how do we deal with this? Because there's always going to be people like this judge, right? Like, I mean, we could go back in time to the Inquisition, and there's people who are like this, who want to spy, who see conspiracies everywhere. And the answer that Captain Picard gives, and, you know, Captain Picard is pretty smart.
Yes.
He says vigilance is the key to defending ourselves from these people, that we have to remain vigilant and we have to we have to guard against the kind of slippery slope mentality that will lead us into sort of a surveillance state or a police state or any kind of anti-freedom state. So, you know, I think that we need to be aware of what we're putting out there. We need to be aware of the things that we share on Facebook and Twitter. But we also, I think, need to be aware of things like Anonymous and other sort of rights-oriented groups that are out there, and perhaps consider that, you know, we should also be considering those important causes of our day.
Good. Yeah. So far we've sort of focused on the U.S. because, well, it's out there. It's in all the news. You have Snowden, you have Manning, and many others have exposed what's going on there. I would like to believe that such things do not happen here in Canada, but I think you'd probably label me a little naive. Regardless, as I've said before, what happens in the U.S. usually happens here within a decade or so. I mean, the robocalls is one of the great vindications of my thesis. Well, according to the Globe and Mail, we are not immune. They reported that our version of the NSA, the Communications Security Establishment Canada, that's what we have here. Did you know that, Ethan?
I didn't know that.
You haven't been monitoring your communications then. But fortunately, they have. The ultra-secret, to quote the Globe and Mail, the ultra-secret electronic eavesdropping agency, the CSEC, has been authorized to collect data trails, phone logs, and their protocol addresses, and other metadata associated with Canada telecommunications. This is being done as part of the continuing efforts to pinpoint Canada's adversaries in the wider world. Now, here's again, what qualifies as a Canadian adversary? I mean, just last year, the Harper government labeled environmentalists like the World Wildlife Federation as terrorist groups. The program was started in 2005 and reauthorized in a top secret directive by Peter McKay in 2011. Unlike in the U.S., where they still usually technically have to go through to get warrants to do this, in Canada, we actually taken quite a different view on it to get their data. Here in Canada, the CSES metadata collection rests on the foundation of legal assumption by the minister and the CSES that they believe metadata telecommunications is largely different from private communications, such as your email and your actual phone calls, and therefore they don't need a warrant to get it. So there isn't even the facade of warrants to get these. Frustratingly, in an issue of oversight, the issue of oversight is, well, kind of twisted. Most parliamentarians can't actually review the operations of this agency because they lack a top secret clearance. However, our privacy commissioner does have that clearance. So where our elected representatives are left in the dark, at least our civil servants are on the job. I like civil servants in general, not all of them. But the privacy commissioner, though, stated that privately, of course, because the program's top secret, so they weren't really allowed to give any details, that because metadata can reveal important things about people, it should be classified as personal information, a recommendation the government has chosen to ignore. I wonder why. Perhaps another lesson of history is during the Weimar Republic, and we kind of talked about this vigilance thing just a little while ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for very good reasons, at the time, the government used its presidential emergency decrees in order to try and get itself out of an economic crisis. Now, of course, they meant it for good reasons, but when suddenly this one person, who I don't know if you've heard of this guy, Hitler, gained power, he took the authority that they had sort of created and used it in a much different way. So even if you trust Obama or, say, forbid Harper, that they will not abuse these powers, well, history has shown once power is available, it's only a matter of time before someone of unscrupulous will have the opportunity to abuse them. For our many American listeners, I hope you remember the whole reason that the FISA courts were created was because of the rampant abuse of surveillance under the Nixon and his predecessor's administrations. Just check out the Church Committee report. It's also ironic to my Canadian ears that Americans fight tooth and nail to prevent the American government keeping track of something like missing guns from gun shops because they believe that the government will track them down and create a police state. Yet they're the very same people who roll over and give up all their Fourth Amendment rights and allow the government to know and track everything but their guns. Don't they know that the gun app marks them as a gun owner? You know, they got in their thing. That when the jackboot state comes down on the Americans, not only will you realize it's not your guns that will keep you free, but information, ironically, that will be the thing that enslaves you. It's stunning.
It is kind of funny how there's such a visceral revulsion to any kind of regulation or tracking of guns, and yet there's almost nothing when it comes to Facebook.
Well, you know, and you sort of hinted there when you mentioned liberty. You know, what was it, Benjamin Franklin, who said people who sacrifice liberty for security get neither.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be... Someone also has, in the gun debate issue, has said that the Americans were stuck in a Civil War era where they were worried about the slaves revolting up, and that's why the guns were so important. And in a way, this kind of shows that 19th century thinking is that they're not thinking that all this other information is actually much more controlling, much more defining mm-hmm. than whether or not you register for a gun or not.
Well, I think it also speaks to our understanding of the world, our new world, because the things that we're paranoid about are not necessarily things that matter, like tracking guns. The things that we don't care about that we think are meaningless, like Twitter and Facebook, are actually pretty important. And this whole, you know, 21st century kind of stuff that's happening, the global village and all that kind of stuff, it's having an increasingly more persistent effect on us. You know, like, it's not simply a matter of we're voluntarily giving information, but it's that we're hooked into it more often.
I was having a conversation with a friend of mine just the other day, and we're talking about how, in an odd sort of way, we're in that in-between age between biological and cyborg. I mean, right now, like I say, cell phones are the most ubiquitous form of it. But, I mean, most people are attached to their cell phones, and they cannot live without them, sort of thing, right? It's not embedded yet. But our way of thinking, our social and cultural institutions, haven't caught up with the fact that we not only have a physical reality, but a digital reality that is just as potent and just as integral to our safety, security, freedom, life, whatever, that the physical world has.
Mm-hmm. Are you enjoying your new Galaxy S4 phone, Don?
Well, you know, I they need to keep track of where I am.
Well, we're almost out of time, so let's go to our skeptical highlights. Don, do you have a skeptical highlight for us?
I have two, kind of. I have one in the vein of what we're talking about. It's Tor, which is it's free software for open networks. Essentially, it allows you to anonymously surf the internet. So it's one of the it was intended largely for places like, you know, in Iran or North Korea or whatever, where you want to go on and you're worried that the government's going to get you. But ironically enough, one of the things that has changed is what used to be paranoid thinking in Canada, U.S., now seems to be, well, no, actually, maybe you're right. Maybe you should sort of do that. So I'm going to have a link on our website to the Tor project. It's T-O-R. You can Google that right now if you wish and let people know. The second highlight I have is, well, we have a secret, folks. This is one of the few episodes that's actually been recorded with a live studio audience. Studio audience, say hi.
Hi.
So we have someone in here who is presenting part of the Atheist Frontier. Explain the Atheist Frontier.
Oh, okay. The Atheist Frontier is a grassroots effort. It's a website that I've started. My name is Randolph Richardson. It's a website I've started that highlights some of the key points of atheism and how it is differentiated from anti-theism, and promoting some skepticism and a large number of resources, and to do mostly with atheism and some education and whatnot. I guess one of the key points that I emphasize with atheism versus anti-theism is that atheism is just an absence of belief, an absence of theism, if you will, versus anti-theism, which is, I guess, naturally opposed to theism.
Excellent, and we'll have a link on our website for that.
Thank
Ethan?
You.
Yeah, I want a quick highlight, kind of a low light, actually, sadly. Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield recently announced his retirement from the Canadian Space Agency, which is really too bad. I think there was some whispers that he maybe would be taking over, running the Canadian Space Agency, but he's not. He's returning to private life, and I hear he's looking for things to do. So, you know, maybe invite him out for some science lectures?
Ooh.
So I hope people will do that, and we're out of time. So this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast.